Thank you, Fred. It's nice to get those kind of jobs, isn't it, where you chairman and don't get to do a damn thing but what you're told. That's kind of the way the AA works. This place looks like a lineup more than which we're used to, I guess, a lot of us. My name's Jack Solomon. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody, and I'm from Louisville, Kentucky, and my sobriety date is August the 21st of 1962, and that may not impress you. It impresses hell out of me, and 28 years ago, I was laying on Skid Row in Louisville, Kentucky, with a bottle of wine and a bad disposition, And little did I realize I was practicing to come to Daytona Beach for Fred. And I certainly appreciate being invited, and the wife and I are here, and I enjoyed it. Came in yesterday from Atlanta. I almost didn't get here. The Atlanta airport was shut down, and when that happens, it's a mess. Lightning and airplanes flying everywhere. I became restless and irritable and discontented. There was a lot of kids up there trying to get to Daytona Beach, and some of them were laying on the floor of the airport kicking and screaming and crying. And my wife looked down at me and said, "Get off the floor." I think that guy Meestern was in AA. He kept saying, "Sit down and more shall be revealed to you." So anyway, 6 hours later we arrive, and we've had a good time ever since, and I'm sure we're going to have a good time the rest of the week, because some of the people that are here I know real well, and I know you're in for a treat, and those that I don't know, I'm certainly looking forward to making their acquaintance. I enjoyed listening to John last night, and maybe what John had to say ought to be said at all these things, and certainly was interesting, and listening to Hal, and Hal the Baptist preacher, that quite familiar with our town up there. We have a big Baptist seminary up there. They're fighting now, and that's about the only force up there that didn't fight for a long time, Hal, but now they're into it. And I enjoyed listening to Dick this morning. I didn't think he was as good as you thought he was, but he was all right. For posterity, and I want this on tape, Dick Martin told Bob Polk that he liked to associate with me because I was one of the smartest men he knew. Isn't that what he said, Bob? Well, he said I was a smart ass. Ain't that the same thing? That same thing, isn't it? Anyway, I am glad to be here, and I've told you that I'm an alcoholic, and I like being ANDA. I don't think it's cool in our society today just to be something. An alcoholic, you ain't cool. You know, I don't like not being cool, so I've become an ANDA. And I think, I like listening to people at this poem that say I'm an alcoholic ANDA. And I won't be an ANDA too, by God. If they're going to be ANDAs, I won't be one. So I'm an alcoholic, and I'm the abused adult spouse of an Al-Anon. And I've got one of them back there with me. She's a black belter. She don't think too much of talking at these conferences. It makes her nervous and upset, and that's fine, but she's a member of the home group here in Louisville, and don't come any better one-on-one, and she certainly helped a lot of people over the years, and I'll introduce her to you in a minute. She got to Al-Anon because my sponsor made her go, and I never married her when I was drinking, so I can say anything I want to. She can't contradict me. She don't know. I never had a wife when I drank, never wanted one. Thought they were useless creatures, really. Most of the women I knew drank, and it never crossed my mind to marry a drinking woman. You get a you get a hold of a half a pint and you got to get somebody half of it. And they were ugly. I never went with too many women who weren't ugly. Just my nature to go with ugly women, and it was their nature to go with ugly men, I guess. I used to go with a girl that went home one night and went in the bedroom, and she forgot to pull her blind down, and she started undressing, and a peeping Tom came up to her window. And when she got about half undressed, he reached in and pulled the blind down. So they just weren't the prettiest things in the world. And that's why I never married. So I did all my drinking and everything on my own. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, or Alcoholics Anonymous came to me, I should say, in 1962, on the 21st day of August. And I was 33 years old. I come from a metropolitan area in Louisville, Kentucky, which is about a population of about a million. And in 1962, at the age of 33, I was the youngest member of Alcoholics Anonymous in the city of Louisville. And they viewed you very suspiciously then, coming in at that age. They thought you, alcoholism had a physical place and it required a tremendous amount of years to accomplish what was necessary for you to become a member here. And you weren't allowed in the doors really till you were about 50, and then they had to scrutinize you real close. And they really did. At the age of 33, they viewed you very suspiciously. And before that, it was even worse. I had a dear friend who recently passed away. Some of you may have known Paul Keebler, and Paul would have been sober about 46 years, I guess, if he's living, maybe 47. And Paul said when he came into AA, they had a measuring stick. If you had 9 teeth, a wristwatch, and could count up to 10, they wouldn't let you in. That you had more teeth to lose, or... And he was one of them old-timers that Hal talks about. And if you want to get to be an old-timer in AA, there's only two requirements. You don't drink and don't die. And they do require that of you. And if you want to be a real old-timer, then you don't drink, don't die, and you have to have hemorrhoids and gray hair. And the reason for that is when you get up here to talk, the gray hair gives you a mark of distinction, and the hemorrhoids a sign of concern. And you look like a real old-timer then. And I'm working on that. But I don't think that Alcoholics Anonymous would have helped me any before the age of 33 and the way things worked out in my life. And I look back on that because I was not the type of a person that could learn from anybody. I've noticed and been very observant over the years, and I look back, and we're all smart in retrospect. And I think since I've been sober and in Alcoholics Anonymous, I am a very observant person because I'm a firm believer that everybody that ever crosses our path will teach us something. The people that are paralyzed in wheelchairs after another drink have taught me. The ones that are dead have taught me. The ones that are in the penitentiary have taught me. The ones that are sober have taught me. And I've never crossed paths with a human being that hasn't taught me something. And so I'm a very observant person of people and now. But before AA, I never was that way. And I think there's only two kinds of people. And I see a lot of young people with us here today that, you know, there's two kinds of people, and those are those who will learn from others. And there are those who will have their own experiences before they learn anything. There are just certain people on this earth, and why they're different, I have no idea, but they just cannot learn from others. They absolutely demand that they have their own experiences. And I was one of those kind of people. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, we know there's a price tag put on that, and we can share that price tag with you. If you're young and new and you're determined to go on with your drinking career, the only thing we have to offer you maybe is to tell you what it's going to cost you. We have no idea of the outcome of it. I don't know whether you'll live or die. I have no idea whether you'll be paralyzed or be able to walk. I have no idea whether you'll be free or incarcerated. But I do know that there's a price to pay, and you'll pay the price. Whether you like to believe that or not, that's immaterial. I'm here to tell you that you will pay the price, and I know what it is. And I'm willing to share that with you if you're 15 or however old you may be. and if you've got to learn from your own. And I'm sure I would have been that way. Just knowing me and knowing the way I am and the way I was, I was not very good at listening to anybody or learning from other people. I'm sure I would have had to have my own. I love stories in AA, and I tell a lot of them, and a lot of people don't like stories, and that's okay. They die sad. But a psychiatrist friend of mine and a good friend and dear friend today, and he's a good man. He's a good advocate of AA. He takes people to AA. But him and I were talking along these lines one day about the way we learn from others or ourselves, and he shared this story with me, and I'll share it with you, and I love it. It was about a woman that had a very polite Polly parrot. And the parrot was so polite when you went to visit, it welcomed you and thanked you for coming. And a lady couldn't get over how polite that parrot was. She said, "My God, how in the world did you ever train that bird?" And the lady said, "Well, I didn't really train him." Said, "He cussed like a Key West sailor." Said, "God, he could filthy mouth parrot." Said, "I got mad at him one day, and I grabbed him by his feet, and I just threw him in the freezer." And she said, "After about 15 minutes, I went back to the freezer to let him out, and I looked at him, and I said, 'Have you learned your lesson? Are you going to quit cursing?'" And the parrot said, "Yes, ma'am, I'll never curse again." And said, "But tell me," said, "what the hell did that turkey do?" So you see, the parrot learned from the turkey. And I'm sure, sitting in this room today, there's some parrots. I'm damn sure there's some turkeys. There's some of you sitting in here, they'll have to skin you, wrap you, and freeze your ass before you'll ever learn anything. You know? But that's the way I'm sure that I would have been. And why was that way, I have no idea. And I'd be willing to share that with you or anybody on this earth if I knew. And I'm sure you can fill psychiatric libraries full of information as to why we're that way when we're young. Why we're that way when we're 14 or 13 or 12. Why is something so attractive to us that it seems in the adult world it's wrong? You know, I had a brother that's 14 months older than I am. He's an executive with General Motors Corporation today because he studied, went to school, and didn't get involved in all that mess. I have two sisters that are younger than I am, and they're both married and have same husbands today and about four kids and good families and all that. And I was sort of the black sheep. But what I found out there in that society was very, very interesting to me. I came from a good home. My mother died when I was about 17 or 18. She's not a big part of my story. My father and I went around and around and around over the way I was. And the income in our house was not a whole lot. We had food and clothing and that kind of thing. But if you had any money, you worked for it. And I come from Louisville, and I'm sure most of you have heard of the Kentucky Derby. It's a very famous horse race. You've probably seen it on television. And the corner where Churchill Downs Racetrack is 4th and Central. And it's a very famous corner. And that's where I lived and died about 100 times. But when I was about 15 years old, World War II was still going on, but just about over in 45 and 44, last part of 44, and things were still rationed, and I got a job in a filling station out there with an older boy as an assistant night manager of a Gulf service station there, and gasoline was rationed, and there was a way to finagle those ration stamps at the end of each month to where you could wind up with a hell of a lot of gasoline you could pump out of those tanks without the coupons. And so the guys that ran those saloons and liquor stores and beer joints around there, they didn't have any gasoline, but they had beer and whiskey, and you couldn't buy that. So they'd come to the filling station with their Cadillacs, and they'd want them filled up. And they'd bring the beer and the whiskey with them, and we'd swap off. And we'd put the beer and the whiskey in a storeroom out there, and we'd drink it or sell it. And a guy ran a drugstore across the street, and he didn't have any gasoline, but he had cigarettes, and you couldn't buy them. So he'd come over with two or three cartons of Luckies or Camels, and we'd fill his car up, and he'd leave the cigarettes, and we'd swap off. And we'd put them back in our storeroom and either smoke them or sell them. And then there was a few girls out there, and they didn't have any gasoline. You'll have to draw your own conclusions. So I got started in a world that was full of things I didn't have, money and sex and excitement, you know. And the booze was in there and you know, Dick was talking this morning about, you know, how alcohol alters your perception, and it's true no matter how it's altering it. You know, it doesn't change the world, but it changes the way you look at it. And if you're fearful or shy or backwards or something, that booze can bring that out in you. Or if you're just out there doing what you think you needs to be done, you see absolutely nothing wrong with that and try to justify it in your own mind. What the hell is wrong with those people that are trying to stop you? You see, the definition of perception is a simple one. Perception means the truth as you see it. Now you think about that. The truth as you see it. And you can imagine what in the hell that world looks like to us in the areas that we consider to be the truth. And God, nothing could be crazier than what we see and what we are and what we do and what we become. And the people standing on the sideline, so to speak, whoever they may be, your wife, your mother, your father, your husband, your children, whatever, they see the truth. You know, they see the truth. And God, you know, what I saw to be the truth, nothing could have been further from the truth. I had absolutely no feelings for anything that I was taught as a child, you know, God, religion, that kind of thing, you know, and I was brought up in an era of Alcoholics Anonymous where you heard a lot of talking about Alcoholics Anonymous being a language of the heart. And that's why I'm such a firm believer that in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's really not important what you know, but it's damned important how you feel. You see, I have known learned scholars who could quote the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have known people in my time that you could pull out of this audience and say, tell us what it says in the second paragraph of page 114, and they can tell you, but they can't stay sober. So it's a program of feeling or a language of the heart. And that phrase goes further when it says that the heart has a language that the mind does not understand. So you see, it's the way you feel about things. And the insanity of my alcoholism, even back then, was that I felt like that what I was okay. I felt like what I was doing was okay. And I felt like I had a God-given right to do it. And I could not understand what in the hell was wrong with those people that thought I didn't have the damn right to do it. And these were my parents. And so you would see my story would differ from somebody that maybe is married with children or something and denying these responsibilities to. But as a young kid, I thought I had every right to do that. And that's why I tell these kids that I sponsor, and I sponsor a lot of the young ones up home, all I want them to understand is that I think it's damned important that you know that I understand you. You know, if you can view me as an old fool, and I'm sure you do, that's okay. If you think I expect you to understand me where I'm coming from at 61 years old, I don't. But I do want you to understand that I understand where you're coming from, and this is what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. And as long as you know that we know what the hell the price is you have to pay. Because whether you like it or not, Con, I feel like it's my responsibility to tell you. Because I sure as the hell don't want to come to the funeral home and feel like you've died in ignorance. But I'm not damn fool enough to think I can stop you. Well, do what you got to do. And all I can do maybe is pray for you. Because I know what it cost. It cost me and cost everybody I ever met. But I was a badass that knew everything. I saw a bumper sticker the other day reminded me of myself. It said, hire a teenager while they still know everything. And I thought, by God, that's me. You know, that was me. And I didn't have any good words framed by it. I knew it all. Couldn't understand that dumbass old man of mine. He wasn't my father. Just old man didn't know nothing. Never had any respect for him at all. I got in trouble. Seems like a squad car is a breeding ground of humility for alcoholics. You set some tough drunks down in squad cars and God, they get humble. Changes their opinion of the world and the people in it. Listen to that guy down at the bar talk about that old bitch he lives with. Lock him up. Give him a quarter and he makes the call. She answers and he says, honey. Went from old bitch to honey just because of a squad car. Take some of them kids, lock them up. They did me when I was about 19, first time. I dropped a dime in that phone. He answered. And I said, Daddy. My father was a black belt Al-Anon and didn't know it. He said, what do you want? I said, I'm in jail. He said, why in the hell did you call me? I said, well, I thought you might come down here and get me out. Oh, he said, I wouldn't worry about that if I was you. By God, I was worried about it. He said, as smart as you are. Oh, he said, I'm sure if you figured a way to get in, you'll figure a way to get out. And hung up. And when I got out, he said, I've never been in jail. I understand they give you one phone call. If I was you, I wouldn't waste it. So I never called him again. And when I came in today and made amends, I never had to ask him what I owed him. I knew what that was, nothing. And my father died in 1970, so I was sober 8 years before my father passed away. And my father and I were the best of friends. My father loved me dearly, and I loved my father. And my father and I were just as close as father and son can get. And we used to laugh about the past, and thank God we can laugh. You know, Dick and I, Peg and Joe and Ann were talking at lunch today about, you know, we just people that don't really take ourselves that serious. And life's that serious, you know. Thank God we can laugh. And my father and I could laugh. We talk about some of the crazy, insane things I used to do, and he'd laugh, and the way he reacted, he'd laugh. Yeah. And we cry sometimes. We wish to hell we'd have knew something about what was wrong with us. Just wish we would have known. Doesn't mean we'd have done anything. We just, it's nice to know. You know, it's nice to know what's wrong with you. So I went for 18 years. Let's see, I started when I was about 15, quit when I was 33. About 18 years trying our way in the world to do what alcoholics do. I got me a job with the Louisville Nashville Railroad up there, and I hung around that racetrack. I used to run around with people that own standard bred or show horses, as they're known, and I had a lot of friends that rode in them. I had a lot of friends that trained them, and they owned them, and you have a little dough to do that, and they had money, and there were shows all over the state of Kentucky, and they would go to them and drinking, and the women, and all that was involved, and I became just so irresponsible to anything. It didn't matter to me. Fun was the most important thing in my life, and when I had that job with the railroad, if somebody wanted to go somewhere and stay a week, I'd go and stay a week. I didn't care. Just didn't matter. You know, and let the chips fall where they may. You know, and I kept believing that. My perception of the world was that's okay. You know, until finally I got to where I couldn't go anymore, and that alcohol kind of made me sick, and it became a desperate thing with puke and hangovers and, you know, and nerves and shaking and all that. And it, you know, and then I got to change my perception. I've got to now make myself believe that it's their fault. You see, if it wasn't for them, then I wouldn't be this way. And God, don't we all, once again, have to alter to make ourselves believe that whatever in the hell is wrong, it's not us. Yeah. And that's why, you know, that's why Alcoholics Anonymous don't work till you change. That's why the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous emphatically states that it's an impossibility for you to ever live sober until you change. You must change your attitude. And until you do, there is no hope. The only difference between the guy that sat on Skid Row 28 years ago and the guy that's in Pompano Beach, Florida is that I've changed. That I've changed. And through this program, I have been able to make the connection I was never able to make. I've been able to connect with society and connect with a God that I can understand. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous does for people like me. It connects us to all the good things in life. When I came here, I didn't want to be connected, because I was able to convince myself there was nothing wrong with me. You can't get much crazier than that. And the insanity that Alcoholics Anonymous talks about, that's exactly what it is. The way you've been able to convince yourself as to what you are. The insanity of your own dishonesty. Insanity comes with honesty. Insanity with this. The bigger liar you are to yourself, the crazier you are. God, you could have got much crazier than I would. And I had a lot of people try to stop me from not drinking that didn't know anything about it. Doctors say if you don't quit drinking, you die. Preachers say if you don't quit drinking, you go to hell. Bosses say you go to unemployment lines. Fathers that say you get the hell out of the house. Judges that say you're going to prison. Cops that say you're going to jail if you don't quit drinking. But what happens to people like you and I when we do quit? There's not anybody sitting in this room that hasn't quit. Our trouble is not quitting. Starting up's what's hell. And the reason for that is I became more miserable when I quit. The unmanageability in my life was sober, not drunk. Oh, I got into some crazy, insane, bizarre things and went broke and mowed everybody and all that silly stuff. But the unmanageability of my life, the misery and tormenting and hell of my life was when I was sober. I didn't do well out there for whatever reason, because I was out there with me. I wasn't connected to anything. And all the experts tried to stop me from getting worse by telling me what the hell was going to happen to me if I didn't quit. And fear doesn't stop alcoholism. We know that here. Dick talked about this morning. Love stops alcoholism. The drinking aspect of it. I've seen experts try to scare drunks into quit drinking. We had an Al-Anon lady up home. Did everything in the world to get that guy quit. She had a sister that was awful too. They were both bad. Her sister, husband never would quit drinking. That poor guy died, and she cremated him. She rolled his ashes with marijuana and smoked him. Said, went around telling people, said, it's the first time in 25 years that son of a bitch ever made me feel good. My wife don't believe that's a true story. One of them Al-Anon women's up there had the idea to get that drunk to quit drinking. She went down to the costume shop and lo and bought a devil suit. And put that devil suit on, wait for that drunk to come home. And he come home about 1 a.m. drunk, and she leaped out behind a hedge at him and startled him. And she says, I've come to get you. And he backed up and looked at her, and he said, who are you? She said, I'm the devil. That old drunk stuck his hand out and said, by God, put her there. He said, I've been wanting to meet you ever since I married your sister. Didn't help. I was able, with all the effort and determination, as brilliant as I was, and the dedication that I had in it, I worked like a Trojan, man, and it only took me 18 years to get Skid Row. And I was living on the city streets of Louisville, having lost my job with the railroad, the respect of my family, everything that was good and decent in my life. And I was walking the streets of the city of Louisville for about a year and a half as a Skid Row bum. Now, I have no regrets for that, and I'll tell you why. I think I was blessed and fortunate, more so than many of you that I've known over the years, because I was a single alcoholic with no children, and I left home and went to live in a gutter. And I have seen so many of you go out and get a gutter and take it home with you. I've seen some of the filthiest, stinkinest living room gutters that are around. I've seen you go get them and drag them home. I've seen you lay in those living room gutters with all the emotional stinking mess that you can generate. I've seen the feelings in families of loneliness and frustration and despair and insecurity and fear. And I've seen alcoholics in their sick minds, honestly to God, believing that the people who love them the most are in some way responsible for what they've become. And they reach out of their living room gutters and drag the people that they love the most down right through that stinking mess with them. I've seen kids take parents. I've seen husbands take wives. I've seen wives take husbands. And I've seen both of them take kids and just drag them through that stinking emotional mess right in the middle of a living room of a $100,000 home. I'm here to tell you that it's a hell of a lot easier to be a single, childless alcoholic that left a home and went to live in a gutter than it is to go get a gutter and take it home with you. And I thank God every day that never occurred in my life. Skid Row is not an interesting place. I could stand here and tell you about it if you want to know, but it's just not interesting. It's a place where you bum, hustle, do whatever you got to do, get a drink in order to live. Meet some interesting people occasionally, like policemen. You know, policemen to me sometimes are so dumb. You know, I've been arrested a lot of times, and a lot of times I wouldn't have been arrested if I hadn't had that opinion of them, but... That policeman tried to run me off of mailboxes when I was leaning on him. You know, and you'd have to explain to him, hell, by God, I'm a taxpayer. I can lean on my part of that mailbox if I want to. You know, your damn business where I lean. They don't appreciate that. I went to jail a few times. But they educate them in those academies, give them big cars and five-cell flashlights. People up where I'm from are getting mugged and raped, robbed, and they're riding down alleys hunting winos. They jump out of their car with that big five-cell flashlight. There was a hardware store there. You'd throw out cardboard cartons we'd sleep in. They'd shine that light in them boxes. You knew they were well-educated by the questions they would ask you. What are you doing? And you'd tell them nothing, and they'd arrest you. And I used to often think, God, I wish I'd have known something about alcoholism when they threw that light on you and said, what are you doing? You could have stuck your head out of that box and said, Officer, I'm progressing. They'd probably locked you up anyway. It would have been interesting. I borrowed some money from a finance company. They couldn't find me. That's interesting. They get upset. Finally, a bartender squealed on me after I owed him for about 8 months and told him where he's back here in that cardboard jungle somewhere. And we'd get them boxes from that hardware store, and like say, sleep in them. You can be a snob wino if you got there early. You get one of them big freezer boxes, and you can lay down in them. You can look at a guy trying to curl up in a TV console box and snob him if you want to. Kind of look at him like he's ruining the neighborhood. They ought to get him out of here. This guy from the finance company, he came by there one day after bartender told him where we were, and it was real interesting to watch him. You could tell he didn't belong there, but anyway, he kept snooping around. He saw me sitting in this box reading a three-day-old racing form with a pint of wine. He finally got up enough nerve, and he came over to where I was, and he knocked on my box. I opened a flap to let him in. He asked me if it's Jack Sullivan. I told him yes. He said something I haven't understood to this day. He said, boy, I'm going to tell you something. If you don't start making some payments on that loan, he said, you're going to be in a hell of a lot of trouble. I don't know what he had in mind. You can't tar and feather people up there. I don't know what it was. And I thought I'd die in that alley, you know, because after all, everything had been done, it could have been done. I was a defiant alcoholic. If you read the 12 and 12 sometime, and I'm not here to tell you that you know, you got to do things for yourself. And in AA, I was brought up that way in AA, and I guess I carry that over to me in AA. If you want to know something, you read it. I ain't going to read it to you. If you want to find out something, you find it. You know? I'll help you any way that I possibly can, but you tell me what you believe after you've read it. I love it when somebody comes with you a problem, they say, well, you know, and you say, read page 86. And then they'll call you up. Hell, there ain't nothing on 86 about what we's talking about, and read the damn book till you find it. That blows them away, you know. Makes them read the book, anyway. Yeah. But I thought that, you know, that I would die there. And I didn't see any way out of that alley. And again, I had nobody to pray to or nobody to think of. You know, and I was talking about defiance. That's where I was defiant towards God. God didn't scare me. I challenged him many times. If you are there, if there is such a thing, look at me. How in the hell could you allow me to become what I am? You know, and were I late in that alley, there was a Catholic church and a Methodist church right there where you could see both congregations going in there on Sunday, and I used to sometimes sit there and mock them, make fun of them, cuss at them, cuss God, you know, because of what I was. And I was a very defiant person to people and to God. And it's an interesting thing, and about half the people come to here that way, and the other half are the opposite. The other half will someday fall on their knees, say, God help me, he does. And everybody, they come to A, there's not really any defiance to them. And they come with some sense of belief. And I was just not that way. I didn't care. And that's why I thought I'd die there. And it didn't matter. You know, what's that song Patti Page sang? Is that all there is? You know, if this is what life is all about, it ain't. It's just not worth it. I was sitting in the back room of that saloon that morning of the 21st day of August of 1962, and I was a pitiful-looking piece of human flesh. I had a real long hair and a beard. All my teeth had been kicked out, and I suffered from dehydration, malnutrition, and it caused you to swell and change colors. I didn't even look like a human being, I guess. And the back door of that saloon opened, and my father walked in with a guy I'd never saw before. I hadn't seen my father in a long time, hadn't talked to my father in a long time, and my father knew where I was. He just couldn't stand to look. You know, it's bad enough on whoever it is in your life just to know. But sometimes it's twice as bad to have to look. And my father didn't, he just didn't want to look. And the guy was with him, I'd never saw him before in my life. And he was a good friend of a vice president that was on the railroad at that time, and he was a guy who had been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous then about 7 years, I guess. And when Mr. Shaw and Jack began to talk one day, Jack was in AA and Mr. Shaw was a vice president with the railroad, and he began to tell Jack about me because he was a good friend of my father's. And what everybody had done for me, and Jack said, nobody's done anything for him. He doesn't even know what's wrong with him. He deserves to be helped. And they said, well, don't he have to call you? And he said, where is he? I'll go see him. So they got my father up there, and my father agreed to come, reluctantly, really, but he agreed to come. And Jack and my father came to this place, and when they walked in that door, I was just dumbfounded. And my father went over and sat on some stools, went around a lunch counter, and Jack came over and sat at the table where I was. And he said, hi, my name's Jack. Jack Dawes. He said, I understand your name, Jack. How you doing? And I couldn't believe that anybody well dressed in a suit of clothes and would come to that place to see somebody like me, and much less and then want to be my friend. And I just, it blows your mind. And I said, yes, you can see not too well. He said, well, I've come out here to help you. I hope you'll let me. I can't help you if you won't let me. And can't I say that to you if you're new? You know, I'd like to help you. And I hope you'll let me. But I can't help you if you won't let me. And I asked him why, because I thought it was the obvious question. Why? Why, stranger, would you care about me? And he said something I didn't believe, but I guess it's the epitome of AA. It's the most profound statement that any of us can make in AA. He said, I used to be like you are, and somebody helped me. I used to be like you are, and somebody helped me. And that's about all I could say to you today. I didn't believe him, but I found out later he was a wino on Skid Row. And I was so damn sick I'd have done anything he said at that particular time in my life. I just didn't care. I asked him later if he said anything about AA. He said he didn't remember, but he didn't think so. I didn't care. I was just as sick. He said, come on, go with me. Your father and I are going to take you to the hospital. And they took me to a psychiatric hospital, which in 1962 was the only place that would admit you. The big book talks about getting in an asylum, and that's what it was, an asylum. Things have come a long way. Today you go to treatment center. Back then you went to an asylum. Terminology makes you feel better, it sounds better, right? Where's your boy? Over to the treatment center. I mean, it just sounds awful when you tell somebody he's in the asylum. We used to shack up. Remember that? Now they have meaningful relationships. That sounds better, doesn't it? Huh? Who's that you're with? You shacked up over there at Howard Johnson's? Oh, no. We're involved in a meaningful relationship. Since I've been out of the asylum. Doesn't that sound awful? Anyway, I was admitted to that psychiatric hospital that day. And strangely enough, that day AA went in that hospital because psychiatry and AA did not G and all back then. And don't get me wrong, I am not saying that critical of psychiatry. Psychiatry saved a lot of lives of a hell of a lot of alcoholics. You know why? They'd admit them to hospitals. Did they treat them wrong or... Yes, but they believed it was right. Their perception of alcoholism was wrong. You know, they thought that it was a secondary symptom of something that they could correct. And they did that honestly. I mean, it didn't work, but they did it in good faith. And so, you know, how can you be critical of somebody like that? But they did let you in, and that was something nobody else would do. And because of the way they treated alcoholics, really, that's why treatment programs began. That's why insurance companies began to pay for alcoholism. Because of the recovered alcoholics, and I happen to be one of them in my community and with my railroad, that was up in arms over what the hell was going on. Why do we have to send somebody over here to be diagnosed as an individual suffering from an underlying emotional disorder when we know damn good well he's an alcoholic? Let's have him diagnosed as an alcoholic and pay for it. And eventually all that came about, what you got today. You know, so, but psychiatry took you in. And on the 28th day of August, a week later, a nurse came in my room. Now, I was feeling pretty good after a week. You know, we get pretty healthy sometimes in 7 days with vitamins and all that stuff they give you. And a nurse came in a room and give me that damn Al-Anon handshake right in my face. You've seen that. She said, don't you go anywhere tonight. We're going to an AA meeting. I said, going where? I'd never heard of AA. Dick said something smart about it being well hidden. It was. I'd never heard of AA. I don't know where in the hell it had been hidden in Louisville. I'm talking about 1962. Well, that's 27 years after AA was started. It was in Louisville in 1941. Yeah. And I never heard of AA. Didn't know anybody in AA. Yeah. And she said, we're going to the AA meeting tonight. And I said, what the hell's an AA meeting? She said, Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, I was offended. I said, Alcoholics Anonymous, are you insinuating that you think I'm an alcoholic? And she said, I'm not insinuating anything. I said, I'll have you know that I'm no damn alcoholic. And that nurse looked me straight in the eye and she said, I'll have you know that if you're not one, there ain't any. And that hurt. Why did I tell her that? 33-year-old Skid Row guy, why would I tell her I was not an alcoholic? Strangely enough, for the same reason a 15-year-old kid will tell you today he's not one. Exactly the same reason. Alcoholics are people that have problems they can't handle. I can take care of mine. And I wouldn't even have them if it wasn't for them. But alcoholics are people that got problems they can't handle, and I don't, sure the hell don't need that. And I said to that nurse, I said, I'll have you know that I'm no damn alcoholic, and I'm not going to your AA meeting. She said, you be back there with me tonight, or I'll put you over there where the doorknobs are on the outside. Now, if you've never been in an asylum or a treatment center, they have architectural defects in them. Some areas, really. They have doors with one knob on them, and it's not on your side. And she said, you be over there where the doorknobs are on the outside. And I thought, well, I believe we'll go. Sort of makes you feel like you're volunteering, right? And I didn't want to go. In 7 days' time, quick operator, back being me, I'd fallen in love in that asylum. And they were having a square dance that night in that auditorium, and I wanted to go over and square dance with that drunken broad I fell in love with in the nut house. And God, I think that's love made in heaven when you see two drunks in love in an asylum. Did you ever go in some of these treatment centers and watch them? God, that's beautiful. I mean, there's two nuts in there. And if you set them down on a bed and put one sock on a foot, they don't know whether to lay down or get up. And they're in love. And they walk around those treatment centers holding hands and blinking eyes at each other. They can't wait till they get out of there. A lot of times they don't. The only thing I know that's dumber than that is somebody that works there tries to separate them. I'm here to tell you that if you work in one of those places and you got two drunks in love, for God's sakes, leave them alone. Do everything in your power to keep them together. Trust me, if you separate them, they'll screw up four people. They were meant for each other. And I didn't want to go, and I was still mad. And the nurse said, don't be so damn arrogant. And I said, well, by God, I don't want to go to any AA meeting. She said, did you ever stop to think you could be wrong about something? I said, no. Don't meet too many alcoholics that are wrong. And if they are, they're not going to admit it. I knew an alcoholic cowboy years ago out west. Come out of a saloon one day, and an old man rode in town on a mule. And that alcoholic cowboy thought he'd have some fun. That old man, he got off that mule, and he asked him if he could dance. That old man said, no, I don't know about dancing. An alcoholic cowboy said, I bet you can dance. He took that six-shooter out and started shooting that old man's feet. The old man got to dancing, counting them bullets. He fired that sixth bullet. That old man reached up on the back of that mule and got shotgun. Looked at that alcoholic cowboy and he said, stuck that shotgun up in his face. He said, did you ever kiss a mule's ass? He said, no, but I've always wanted to. No, but I've always wanted to. Damn if I'm going to be wrong. Ain't my fault. Yeah, ain't my fault. Well, if there is anything problem around here, you ought to see the people that caused it. Ain't me. Guy walking down the street one time up in Louisville with both of his ears burned. And a fellow said to him, how in the name of God could a man burn both ears? Oh, he said, I went home last night drunk. Said the wife was ironing, and we got in a big argument, and the phone rang. He said, I reached over to pick that phone up and got that damn iron and stuck it in my ear. The guy said, well, that explains your right ear is being burned. How'd you burn the left one? He said, that son of a bitch called back. It has nothing to do with drinking, has nothing to do with arguing, has nothing to do with anything. That son of a bitch called back. And that's exactly the way I thought. Well, she came and got me, and I went down that meeting with a nurse, had me by my earlobe, and I started in this classroom door at this psychiatric hospital, and there stood some old woman in the door, and I was one of them big, tough, macho drunks, and that old woman, about 60 years old, named Margaret Bivin, and these people I mentioned are dead, and if they weren't, I wouldn't even be using their names, but she was a beautiful old lady, about 60, and I'm 33, and she smiled at me, and I got that image of me, you know how we are. And that old broad put her arm around my shoulder and smiled. She said, hi, honey. She said, honey, would you like a cup of coffee and a cookie? And I thought, I wonder where in the hell she thinks I'm from. Anyway, I blew past her and went in there and sat down. And somebody had got up to talk like I'm doing tonight. And they wanted me to sit there and listen. I wasn't too good at that. He talked and I talked. Made an ass out of myself, you wouldn't believe. When that meeting was over, I came away from with a brilliant conclusion. Anybody drank like he did, ought to quit. I mean, I would if. And I haven't got there yet. Kills a lot of alcoholics, doesn't it? I haven't got there yet. And if he knew the reasons behind why I was there, he could see there was no similarity between me and him. And that's what makes Alcoholics Anonymous work. Our ability to identify. Okay. And that was something Jim was talking about last night. It ain't right. You know? It ain't right to bring a new man to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that's got a hell of an alcohol problem. And unbeknowingly to me, the guy that brought him, and to him, the guy with the alcohol problem, have standing in AA meeting list to a cocaine addict. See, it ain't right because I don't identify. And if I can't identify, I can't be helped. I must identify in order to be helped. And there's people to identify with. But I have to identify with an alcoholic. Anyway, I started out of that room and that old woman grabbed me again. After I made ass out of myself and her, you wouldn't believe, smiled, put her arm around me, and she said, honey, you come back next week now. We need people like you. And I thought, they ought to put that old broad in a home somewhere. You know, get her off the street. So I went back there next week and sat down next to some old man I didn't like. I didn't know him, hadn't seen him right week before, but didn't like him. Grouchy looking old fool. He said, hi, boy, how you doing? I thought it ain't none of his business. He don't work here. What the hell does he care how I'm doing? Well, maybe you ought to be nice to old people. I really believe that today. I said, I'm doing all right, old man, but I ain't no damn alcoholic. And he looked at me and he said, well, if you ever find out what's wrong with you, you ought to do something about it. You look like hell. I got up and moved. My psychiatrist told me I never grew up. I was emotionally immature, didn't know who I was, or, you know, all that good kind of stuff. And I went back the following week, told that old man, said, how you doing? I said, I'm doing fine. I ain't no alcoholic. My psychiatrist said I didn't know who I was. He said, I believe that. And he said, if I hadn't been here and hadn't been done this and hadn't been done that, all these things wouldn't happen. If I'd grow up and mature and all this, that old man laughed. He said, boy, I'm going to tell you something. If you'd have been a grape picker in the Garden of Eden, you'd have been a drunk. I got up and moved. That old fool became my sponsor. About, Why does it work out that way? It does, doesn't it? He get old boy, he was something else. God, how gay I love that old man. Yeah. I still got a dime he gave me for a telephone call. You know, back then he'd give you a dime and call me if I can help you. Don't you drink with my dime. And don't you dare call me if you start drinking. You see, that was a lot of what Jim was talking about last night, a lot of one-on-one, like good people on each other, you know. Because you know what, it hurt them. And I'm that way today with the guys I got at home. It hurts me. It really hurts me if you think more of a drink than you do me. And I've told you, I understand you. And I can understand why you want it. And I can understand how you've always reacted to certain situations. You know? But God, it hurts me to think that you really think more of a drink than you do me. And that's the way he was. I'll go anywhere at any time to help you. Call me. But if you drink, throw my dime away and don't call me. Because you think more of a drink than you do me, it does me as much harm as it does you. And I still got his dime, and Gay still got some of his candy. He'd give candy to the ladies. He wouldn't give you a piece of candy if you was a man. I lost $5 one night betting I could get a piece of that candy. I took that old goat to Frankfort, Kentucky, about 50 miles away one night for him to speak at an AA meeting. And a guy put me on honesty, and I said, $5, I'll get a piece of that candy. He said, $5 says you don't. Tell me when you come back. He would not give you a piece of that candy. And all the way up there, I'm going. I said, he already gave me a piece of that candy, man. Throw it, he'd say, buy your own candy. My throat's dry. I'll stop and get something and give you a piece of it. Give it back to you or something. He said, stop and get some. I never got a piece of candy. And he was that way. He was a good old man. Something else. And he tolerated me. I left that hospital and went to another hospital for 40 days and came back to Louisville and started going to Alcoholics Anonymous primarily because I was afraid not to go. You know, I believe that a drink separated me from that alley. A drink separated me from that concrete. You know, back in March, I quit smoking because I was coughing a whole lot. And I sponsored about 3 doctors, and one of them was telling me that my coughing was the beginning of emphysema. He said, I'm not telling you to quit smoking. Never told me to quit smoking. And I saw on that cigarette what I saw in that bottle. You know, it was going to put me in a house. It was going to put me where I couldn't breathe. You know, and I tell people all the time, I never had a bit of trouble, quit smoking, my right hand to God, not one ounce of trouble because of the association of what it was doing to me. I could really see it was killing me, and I could really see the same thing with alcohol. So I stayed in AA just not drinking. They never gave me any big books. They said, hell, he's too dangerous to have a big book. You know, I mean, I was argumentative, defiance, and everything. They said, man, you don't need to read nothing. You know, they just hung me around, you know. The only thing I knew was Sandy Beach and I laugh at the guy you're going to hear Saturday night. He's a great guy, Sandy and I laugh. But the only thing you knew back then was don't drink, go to meetings, and get in the car. That's all you ever heard, you know. And they said, sit down and shut up. You went to speaker meetings and listened and tried to identify. No such thing as discussion meeting. Never opened your mouth. You had nothing to say. They weren't interested in your opinion. You didn't read anything. You just hung around with them. And Dick mentioned Smartbeek again. They knew if you stayed long enough, you'd have to want to become like them because the way they lived was so much different than the way you lived, and it was common sense observation. It was nothing you had to know, only what you had to see. And if you run with the right people in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's what you're seeing. You're seeing people who live in a manner that is exactly the opposite of yours. And you can make a decision clear-headed and off of that garbage as to which way you would rather live. Like they do or like you do. Now, if you decide you'd like to live like they do, then there's certain things you have to do. There are certain things you must do. It wasn't 90 meetings in 90 days. It was every day. You know, there was no time limit of a year. Somebody said to my sponsor one time, what do you do different today than you used to do? 17 years sober. He said, nothing. And I thought, God, you got to go every night for 17 years? You know? I mean, because they did. Yeah. And you sit there and you begin to see and understand what the hell it was. They were people who seemed to have a secret to where they could live out there with some degree of peace and happiness and sanity without needing a drink. How in the name of God did they do it? And they said, sit down and we'll show you. And they would tolerate your argumentativeness. See? So it's interesting sometimes if you argue. And if you're one of them defiant people, hell, I'll argue with you. They argued with me. You know, how do you argue with somebody that you're not powerless over alcohol or the unmanageable life on Skid Row? How do you argue with somebody you're absolutely not crazy when your perception of yourself is so much different than the way you really are? The truth to you means nothing. Because you can't see the truth for what it really is. And in due process of time, I said to these people, I want you to understand one thing. I do not believe in God. And they looked at me and said, who cares? I mean, that hurt. I said, don't God care? They said he couldn't care less. You see, it was explained to me, and I explained it to the kids I fool with, that what I believed in brought me here. What I believed to be true made me what I was, a Skid Row bum. And what I believed in or didn't believe in was as unimportant as it could possibly be to the people in Alcoholics Anonymous and to Almighty God Himself. You see, because irregardless of what I believed in, the most important thing in my life at that time was what they believed in. You're new to AA, I believe you can be all right. I believe you can make it. You know something? So does God. God believes in you. He really doesn't care what you believe in. Because he knows it's either or. Either you'll stay here till you come to believe, or you'll leave. And if you leave, all we do is pray that you live long enough to come back. If you stay, you will come to believe. And I did, thank God, long enough to take the action that was necessary through the rest of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to change my life. And I met Gay, and Gay and I got going together and real serious about each other, and I told Hillary about Gay. He said, bring her up here. I said, hell, she's marrying me, she ain't marrying you. He said, bring her up here. You didn't ask why, you just did what they told you. I brought her up there. Hillary looked her over and sent her to Al-Anon. And he appointed Mary Louise and Charlie, you take her. And they took her to Al-Anon in 1963. And since that day and time, and we're still together and had a good marriage after all these years, and the 7th day of September, it'll be 27 years of marriage, and where she's here today. Stand up, Gay. That's that lady right there. And I got my job back with that railroad in 1964. And in 1974, they sent for me and asked me to start an alcohol and drug abuse program for a railroad in Louisville, Kentucky, called the Louisville and Nashville, that ran in 13 states. And we eventually merged with the Seaboard Coastline out of Jacksonville, Florida, that runs through here, I'm sure. So I was part of an enormous network of railroad and in the area of alcohol and drug abuse. And because of that, you know, we had a great life, and I was able to retire in January of 1988. When it got so big, they offered buyouts, and I retired, and I don't do anything. It takes me till noon to get started. Had one of them young kids over my house the other day, them youngins. They irritate me sometimes. He's 20, I think. One of them smart asses that Dick talks about. Come in the house and said to my wife, said, "Where's Jack?" And she said, "Sitting over in that chair." My wife looked at Eric and says, "I think I'm going to bury him standing up. I believe the change of positions would do him good." And that boy looked at her and says, "Why don't you bury him face down so he can see where he's going?" And then he said something caused me to get mad at God. I've been mad at God for 3 months, run God out of the house, ain't let him in, don't know to let him back in. Ain't talked to him for a while, don't know the will. Never thought he'd turn on me too. I know God turned on me for what this kid said. I said, "How in the hell did you get in my house, boy? Come over here tormenting me. Who let you in?" And he said, "According to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, God sent me to you." And I ain't spoke to God since. I'm scared to death he'll send me another one. I'm kidding. We have a lot of fun and a great life, and a good life. And I changed, you know. I changed and learned what the things that AA has taught me to do, you know. AA just asked me to grow up, not to lay in a hole and rot somewhere. You know, they asked me to learn to laugh and not cry. You know, to love and not hate. You know, and that's what our whole program is based on, you know. We're better people because of each other, and that's the love that's in AA. If I tell you I love you, whether you're a boy or a girl, and I don't love you for what you are. When I look at you and say I love you for what I am when I'm with you. You see, because of you, I'm better. Maybe in some small way, because of me, you're better. But I love you for that. I love you. Because of you, I'm a better person today. And I know damn good and well that because of each other, we're all better people today. Yeah. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, the people in it, the connection we've made with the God we understand, you know, we're capable and able of living in that society out there to some degree of peace and happiness. Without all that damn conflict in our lives, in a manner that I never dreamed possible 28 years ago, laying on concrete, sleeping in cardboard boxes. I'll tell you a story that I close every AA talk I make with. I heard it many years ago. I've never forgotten it, and I hope you don't. It was about a man walking down a very cold and lonely road one night. In the middle of the road laid a snake. When the man passed the snake looked up and spoke to him. He said, "Mister, please help me. I'm laying in the middle of the road, freezing. I'll die if you leave me here. Please help me. I cannot stand the bitter cold. Pick me up and put me under your coat and get me warm that I might live." And the man said, "I can't do that. You're a poisonous reptile. And surely to God, if I'd help you, you'd bite me." And the snake said, "I wouldn't bite you if you saved my life." And the man thought for a minute and picked him up and put him under his coat. And when the snake got warm, he bit him. And the man grabbed him out from under his coat and threw him back to the road. And he looked at him and he said, I thought you promised if I helped you not to bite." And with a snickering grin on his face, the snake looked at him and said, "You knew what I was when you picked me up." My friend, if you're sitting somewhere someday in the confines of your own home or bar or cocktail lounge or wherever it may be, justify it to those who care to hear. rationalize it to yourself if necessary. But if you've been here, if you know me, if you've met us, you know what it is when you pick it up. Thank you for having me in Tatona.